Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter investigates the impact of climate change and wildfires on California's most iconic trees. And a state program provides free hotel rooms for farm workers with COVID-19. So why have so few used them? But first, you've probably seen the Associated Press photo of Valley Congressman Jim Acosta and other representatives taking cover as pro-Trump extremists try to break into the House chamber at the U.S. Capitol Wednesday. What's going on in the chamber when the insurrection occurred, and what was Acosta thinking about? He described the scene to reporters shortly after he was escorted to a safe place.
Well, because of the pandemic, we were limited to how many people could be on the floor because of social distancing, and we had our masks on. And when the assembled at 1 o'clock, according to the schedule, we began the process. We heard the results of Alaska and Alabama. And the next state was Arizona. And then there was the notice of protest on the certification of the ballot submitted by Arizona. And it was confirmed by Senator Ted Cruz. And then we began the debate. And it was to be as much as a 2-hour long debate. And I was sitting in the gallery watching the proceedings. And we began hearing noises taking place outside. And we heard a couple of efforts that there were activities out on the Capitol grounds, but that we should remain in place. And after those two interruptions, about an hour into the proceedings and to the debate, they indicated that protesters had been able to successfully stormed the Capitol, and they were in the rotunda, and then they were coming toward the House chambers and in the Senate chambers, and that they began an evacuation first on the floor and then on the in the House gallery where I was seated at the time. And then we were told that tear gas had been used in the rotunda, and we were asked to under the seats. We have going back to 9/11, when there was a threat that one of the airliners were possibly coming to the Capitol, there are these gas masks that we have under our seats to grab for them and pull them out and be prepared to put them on. And then we began to hear some of the protesters storming the doors at the opening of the House chambers, where normally Americans, when they watch the State of the Union, I hear the Sergeant of Arms say, "Madam Speaker, Vice President Pence, the President of the United States," and they began to storm those doors, in which Capitol Police then were on the other side, and we were all asked to hit the ground, or the floor, I should say, and that's where the photo that you saw on AP, and of course, I don't know for how long we were there before they were able to secure and push back the protesters, but what seemed to be 10 or 15 minutes, we were then walked all around the gallery and asked that we were going to then go down and go over to a more secure site away from where the protesters that were really taking on a treasonous act by attempting to overthrow not only the election, but to take over a branch of government. Unheard of. And on the way out and down the stairs, the police had a group of these protesters who were engaged in this treasonous act on the floor with their hands behind their back, trying to ensure that hopefully they had no weapons and would not create harm.
A reporter then asked Costa about the overall mood among representatives and what it was like to be moved into a committee room where they waited out the insurrection.
I think about 300 of the members of the House were put in a separate committee room for about 2 hours, Republicans and Democrats alike, and some staff people. And so while we had our masks on, we weren't able to do the social distancing that we normally would do. But we certainly had an opportunity to speak with one another about what had just taken place. And obviously, there were the various reactions that you would expect among Democrats and Republicans. I think that all of my colleagues, almost, that I spoke with, thought it was clearly outrageous of these individuals to take upon themselves to storm the Capitol and to engage in lawlessness, and then to actually, it's not clear how the person was shot and killed, but to storm the Senate chambers and the Speaker's office, and it's not clear yet what other damage may have taken place that that these individuals were engaged in. But I can tell you that for a lot of my colleagues, there was a level of fear. For a lot of the staff members, there was a level of fear. And for members of the press,
Costa described the mob's action as treason, not patriotism.
We protect everybody's First Amendment's right to protest. Protests are very common here in our nation's capital. We've had them, you know, throughout our history. And I support every American's right to come to our nation's capital and to peacefully protest their concerns about whatever issue they have concerns about. That is part of the beacon of light that America holds, and it's part of our values. But storming the Capitol and bringing arms onto the Capitol and marching into the Senate floor and sitting behind the desk where the vice president sits to preside over the Senate, or to storm the Speaker's office, those are all treasonous activities. That's not the action of a patriot. Patriots respect our country and our democratic values and the ability to agree to disagree. And I defend every American's right to peacefully protest and to be a patriot in every way that reflects the norms of our country. But storming the Capitol to shut down one branch of government is an act of treason. Let's be clear about that. That's not an act of patriotism.
That was Jim Costa, who represents California's 16th Congressional District, talking about Wednesday's siege of the U.S. Capitol. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Since the new year, FM89's Madi Bolaños has been reporting on COVID-19 inside Coalinga State Hospital from the perspective of its residents. They're so concerned about living conditions that some would rather be deported than remain at risk of contracting COVID-19 there. The Department of State Hospitals tracks virus cases on its website, but some residents and families worry the true impact of the disease is obscured by the institution's poor record of notifying families when their loved ones inside the hospital die. FM89's Carrie Klein brings us this report.
In late December, Clementine Sanders called her son at Coalinga State Hospital to make sure he had received her Christmas card. But his bunkmates informed her son, 58-year-old Shannon Starr, had died 3 weeks earlier.
But I still wasn't notified, and I still haven't heard from the prison.
Then she and her daughter called the coroner's office, who informed them Starr's body had already been cremated and his ashes disposed of off the coast of San Luis Obispo County.
I'm just numb. I don't know what to do. I'm upset, but I don't know exactly who to be upset, but except them, and I can't talk to them.
No one told Sanders that Starr had tested positive for COVID-19 before he died. A representative of the Fresno County Coroner's Office said he died of cardiac arrest, a pulmonary embolism, and kidney failure. It's unclear if the virus played a role in his death. Starr was one of more than 350 patients to have contracted the virus at Coalinga, around a quarter of the hospital's population. At least 12 have died, according to a state website. Some, however, suspect the death toll is higher, including James Heidrich, who's been a patient at the hospital for 14 years. He says many of the men who have died in recent months were never tested for COVID-19. He also says in a few cases, when he's reached out to loved ones of those who have died, he's discovered the hospital had never informed them.
They simply feel that they have no obligation to notify family members of their loved one's passing.
Coalinga is not a prison, but it's not a typical hospital either. It's a state-run facility that houses felons, most who committed sex crimes. They've served their prison sentences, but a court has determined they're not yet fit for a life of freedom. Heidrich, like many others, calls it a shadow prison.
When patients die from Coalinga, they die being handcuffed to a bed. They're not allowed to see their family, receive phone calls, or anything.
A representative of the Department of State Hospitals says when a patient dies, the hospital will make every effort to reach out to a next of kin or emergency contact, including phone calls and letters. She says the department could not legally comment on why Shannon Starr's family had never heard about his death. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Well, some good news for a change. Paychecks are going up this year for California's minimum wage workers. As part of our effort to tell you about the new California laws taking effect this year, our colleague at Cap Radio's Steve Milne has this report.
People who make minimum wage aren't just teenagers at fast food restaurants anymore.
That was more true decades ago, like in the 1970s. Now, that's definitely not the case.
Ben Zipperer is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He says low-wage workers are more likely to be older, women, and people of color. California's minimum wage is now $14 an hour for companies with 26 or more workers and $13 an hour for smaller businesses. The increase is part of a law signed by Governor Jerry Brown a few years back, requiring the minimum wage to go up every year until it reaches $15 an hour by 2022. Zipperer says minimum wage workers don't typically get hazard pay, even though a lot of them deal with the public, which during a pandemic can be especially hazardous.
Efforts to, you know, raise low-wage workers' raises are ways to kind of counteract the fact that the market isn't actually providing them with that compensating wage increase that we would like to see in the most dangerous jobs.
Another new state law that took effect expands paid family leave for people who work in companies with five or more employees. In Sacramento, I'm Steve Milne.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Joshua trees, redwoods, and giant sequoias are California's defining tree species, and all three have been deeply impacted by climate change and wildfires. John Branch, a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist, recently explored this issue in an article titled, "They're Among the World's Oldest Living Things. The Climate Crisis is Killing Them." I spoke with Branch about his reporting, and he started the conversation by discussing how he got the idea to group these iconic trees into one article.
You know, it actually started back in August with the Joshua trees in the Mojave Preserve. And I thought that's an interesting angle, a species in an area of the state that we have not written a lot about or heard a lot about when it comes to wildfires. And before, frankly, I could get down there to do some reporting, other fires had broken out, and including in the redwood forests near Santa Cruz. And I thought, well, there's a second area that we don't normally think of with wildfires, you know, the really foggy, moist coasts of the redwood forests. And I thought, well, there's a second area that might be an interesting angle. And certainly when the Creek Fire and the other fires of the Sierra Nevada were breaking out, I thought, well, there's the sequoias. And just kind of clicked in my head that those are the three trees or the three species that are probably the most iconic in California that were now suddenly at risk simultaneously in three very different environments, three different parts of the state. They're the three species that have national parks named after them. And so just from a reporting perspective, I thought maybe it makes sense to somehow combine them all into one story.
So in talking about what you discovered in the course of your reporting, you described it as heartbreaking, surreal, and hopeful. Can you just break that down for us?
Yeah, I mean, I had the privilege of going into these burn areas with scientists, and it really is heartbreaking to see these different trees burned out. I mean, when you go to the desert landscape and see literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, they believe it's about 1.3 million Joshua trees just burned, just nothing but sticks. When you go into a sequoia forest, and we've all seen the remnants of the wildfires, but when you see trees that are literally, you know, 300 feet tall and 36 feet in diameter that have lived there, stood in that exact place for 2,000 years or more, and now they're gone. They're just burned and they're not coming back. That's tough. You know, we can replace buildings. We can replace a lot of the things that burn during these wildfires. But, you know, as one of the people I talked to, and I quoted in the story says, you know, they're irreplaceable unless you have 2,000 years to wait. There are signs of hope, you know, in some of those places where you see some of the things, some of the trees coming back. The redwood forests of these three are the most resilient. And even though some of these trees look like they have been burned almost to a crisp, there are signs of life in the redwood because the redwood's a little bit different in terms of its ability to regenerate. So, you know, you see sparks of green that kind of make you realize it's all part of a cycle. But I think it's important to sort of stop and take account of what we have lost.
You know, I'd like to focus on the giant sequoias. Many of these trees, obviously, as you mentioned, are thousands of years old and as such have lived through countless wildfires. I mean, in my understanding of giant sequoias, I've always thought of them as fireproof, more or less. And you say in your reporting that, you know, what generally brings down an old growth giant sequoia is old age. What has changed?
Yeah, what has changed in simple terms is just the severity of these fires. You know, as we've all seen in the past few years, but, you know, never more than in 2020, these fires are now bigger, hotter, taller than we've ever seen before, at least in modern history. You know, there were videos and pictures of these giant plumes of smoke that now reach tens of thousands of feet into the atmosphere. What's changed in a longer form of that answer is these trees have been adapted to fire or have been used to fire all throughout their lives, either through lightning strikes or through intentional fires set by indigenous tribes to help clear the forest. The tree ecologists can find records through the rings of these trees that show that typically every 10 or 20 years, there's a fire through most of these sequoia groves that has kind of limited the amount of fuel on the floor of the forest. The sequoias have thick enough bark, their canopies are high enough up in the air that they have avoided serious damage from these low fires. And those have been healthy fires. And if you've been into a sequoia forest, and same with redwoods, you will see that often you'll see the bark of these trees are charred from fires that might have been hundreds of years ago. So they were used to fires, they were accustomed to fires. But now these areas have not had fires generally for the past 100 years. You know, we have had a history in California here of suppressing forest fires for the past 100 years or so. And so these fires or these forests now are denser and denser and denser than ever before with really what becomes fuel for larger fires. Not to go too deep into the weeds here, but, you know, we also had a big drought from 2012 to 2017, which killed millions of acres of conifer forests in the Sierra Nevada. We've had beetles, which then followed along and killed more and more of these trees. After 5 or 6 or 7 years of dead trees, those trees start to fall. And now the forests are clogged with a lot of dead underbrush. And so what we've seen, especially in the last 5 years, and again, never more than in 2020, is all this fuel is now igniting and burning bigger and bigger fires, which now reach high into the canopies of these giant sequoias. And once the fire gets into the canopies of the sequoias, then they're at risk of dying.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting in your reporting was when you made mention of the fact that the Sequoia National Park had been considered a model of forest management or maintenance, I should say, because it was among the first to embrace prescribed burns, at least here in the West. But it seems as if, from what you're saying, that burn program just could not keep pace with the effect of climate change and the amount of fuel that was on the forest floor. What have you learned in the course of your reporting and the experts that you've talked to about what this means for the future and how the park can move forward?
Yeah, I think you put it just right in that they've just not been able to keep up. And I think if you talk to those people at Sequoia National Park and Redwoods National Park and Yosemite, they'll say that, yeah, we've had these fire, prescribed fire programs. We've been very proud of them in the past, but it's just not enough anymore. You know, doing a few hundred acres a year is not any match for what we're now seeing, where thousands of acres are burning in a matter of hours. You know, these fires have become big enough that they now create their own kind of weather systems. And so they burn much more quickly, they burn more hot. And so they're just trying to keep up. And I think where they thought that for years, they might be able to stay ahead of these kinds of fires by doing prescribed burns and doing burns in very specific areas where they can analyze where potential wildfires might come and can we protect this grove and can we protect this community? Now, again, is just no match for the size and the speed and the ferocity of the fires that we're seeing now. And so the lesson is, at least according to, you know, all these experts that know more about this than I do, is that we just have to do more. We have to prescribe more and more burns. And it's certainly a tricky, tricky thing because not everybody wants to have prescribed burns anywhere near them. There's a lot of towns in these foothills and in these mountains. Nobody wants to smoke. Central Valley, for example, certainly doesn't need any more particulates in the air. So trying to get all these different jurisdictions on board to prescribe more and more fires is going to be the big challenge, I think, for a lot of these folks.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a politically tricky situation. I remember talking to forest management experts back during the fire season, and they basically said, it's a question of, do you want your smoke a little at a time or do you want it all at once? And I think nobody wants to relive 2020 again, certainly. Can you, before we wrap up though, just talk about the long-term impact that last year's fire season have had on these treasured trees and what we can expect in the future?
Yeah, I think a couple of the things that stick with me is, you know, there are only about 70 sequoia groves left in the Sierra Nevada, about 45 or 48,000 acres. You know, you can count the number of ancient sequoias. And people are not so worried about them becoming extinct, but they are worried about losing the old ancient trees. And what do we lose when we've lost those ancient trees? Well, we certainly wouldn't all go into the mountains to Sequoia National Park and Kings Canyon and Yosemite to go gaze at them. You know, there's a spiritual element to this. There's a humanistic element to this about what these trees mean. There's a reason why sequoias are different than other species of trees. They're magnificent. They're the biggest trees on earth. There's something that they do for us. And to lose or potentially lose all of the old growth ones, I think is a frightening prospect. And this past year, you know, let me step back. In the past 5 years or so, 2/3 of those groves have burned. That's more than had burned in the previous 100 years. And of those 2/3 that have burned, about half of that was just in 2020. And so the fires are coming and more of them are coming. And I think people are starting to take stock of what we do, not only to protect ourselves, certainly first and foremost, but what do we do to protect our environment? And how do we decide what is worth protecting? And I would imagine a lot of folks would say the giant sequoias are a species that we need to put at the top of the list in terms of what we're trying to protect.
Well, New York Times reporter John Branch, thank you so much for your incredible reporting and for taking the time to talk with us about it.
Really is my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. In an effort to assist farm workers who test positive for COVID-19, California launched the Housing for the Harvest program. It provides free hotel rooms so farm workers can self-isolate and not infect family members. But a recent investigation found that of the 800,000 farm workers in California, only around 80 have utilized the program since it was announced in July. To learn more, I spoke with the journalist behind that investigation, Jackie Botts, economic inequality journalist with CalMatters, Kate Simini with the Salinas, Californian and CalMatters California Divide Project, and Georgia G with the Documenting COVID-19 Project at Columbia University.
Jackie, I'd like to start with you. How much did fear over immigration status play into this program's lack of success?
According to everyone we talked to, so farm workers themselves, community advocates, local and state officials, that was a big concern. I'd say that we probably heard about three main concerns. One is just a fear of being detected by the government if you're undocumented or your family members are. Putting your name on a list, whether it's a county, state, or federal list, is a scary prospect. And that's even though the program actually doesn't record people's names. Instead, they use an individual moniker. But people don't necessarily know that, and just the prospect of putting your name on a list is scary. Another fear that came up was that of the Trump administration's public charge rule, which theoretically would make it harder for people to be approved for a green card or citizenship if they've used public benefits. That rule is actually on pause right now in federal court in California, and the federal government specifically said that it doesn't apply to coronavirus care in relief, but there's still a lot of fear about it. And then the last thing that we heard repeatedly from advocates is the very real fear of family separation. So I spoke to Fernando Serrano, who runs a food pantry for farm workers in Tulare County, independent from the county itself. And he's been speaking with a lot of families who need help, many who have actually had the virus in their homes. And he said that when people hear about housing for the harvest, they think family separation. They think my loved one is going to be locked in a room while sick and I can't care for them and know how they're doing and what if I don't see them again. And he said that when he initially told people about housing for the harvest, he noticed that it was like a red light went off in their head. They sort of shut down, became fearful. He didn't want them to associate him with the government or with his program, and so he actually stopped mentioning it to farm workers who were in need of help.
Georgia, I understand that in order to be eligible, you need both a positive COVID test and a referral from a doctor. I'm wondering how big of a hurdle did those two requirements present?
Yeah, they showed up to be really big hurdles. So I filed public records requests to nearly a dozen counties in California, and they all the internal emails showed similar trends. So, for example, in May in Monterey, a doctor wrote that undocumented workers who had gone to the ER with COVID symptoms were getting billed, and the word was getting out, and it was becoming a huge barrier because farm workers were afraid. And there was also a lack of free testing, particularly in Fresno County. And then, like all the fears that Jackie's listed, when they did set up mobile testing, no one showed up. So you're kind of straddling this problem here of how are people going to obtain housing when they can't get free testing and they're worried about getting billed when they go to the ER.
So Kate Simini, you're a reporter with the Salinas, Californian. Can you tell us about the origins of the Housing for the Harvest program? My understanding is that it was inspired by a Monterey County program that was fairly successful housing farm workers and their dependents who had tested positive for COVID. What did that program do right that this statewide program got wrong?
Yeah, so Housing for the Harvest, you know, was based on the Grower Shipper Association's COVID-19 housing program for farm workers and dependents if they'd been exposed or, you know, had tested positive for the virus. When I spoke with the president of Grower Shipper, Chris Valadez, one of the things we talked about was how GSA managed to attract so many people. They had housed as of December, I think 401 people, which so that's not just farm workers. It could also be spouses, could be children, et cetera. And what Chris pointed out was that they tried very hard to lower barriers. So they weren't affiliated with the government. There was not that immigration or status fear. They didn't request a COVID test. They didn't request identification even. They didn't even request, you know, payment upfront for this. It was employer sponsored. So employers would pay for their employees to quarantine or isolate in these hotel rooms. And, you know, they had laundry service, they had nurse check-ins, they had food brought every day, et cetera. And when we looked at Housing for the Harvest, it wasn't quite the same because there's federal money involved. They needed to have these, you know, positive tests. They needed to have a doctor's referral. People needed to have identification, and so on and so forth. It is worth noting, though, that advocates we spoke with in the Monterey County area said that the grower-shipper program still wasn't perfect. They pointed out that it wasn't very well known among workers. Many wanted a place to quarantine but couldn't find it, and GSA really was aimed at employers who were interested in participating. So if an employer didn't participate in the program, their employees couldn't either.
For those who did contact the program, but let's say ultimately declined the hotel, what happened next? Did they receive any kind of help beyond, you know, that ability to stay in a hotel room?
So for grower shipper, no, that was not something that was offered. It was really focused on getting people isolated in hotel rooms. For housing for the harvest, the services varied county to county, but there were a number of wraparound services offered for people who got in touch with Housing for the Harvest, but decided that ultimately isolating just wasn't for them. You know, in Riverside County, for example, they offered a one-time cash stipend of up to $2,000, groceries. Other counties offered laundry services, nurses called to check in, and so on and so forth.
So Jackie Botts, your reporter with CalMatters, can you just expand on that and what, let us know what you heard from the advocates you talked to about what they recommend for the future. You know, these monies that have been allocated for this program to provide hotel rooms, should they be used to support farm workers in other ways, given how underutilized the program was?
Sure. There was definitely a theme amongst advocates we talked to. We talked to folks with United Farm Workers, Líderes Campesinas, which is a network of women farm workers, number of other organizations that are really tapped into the farm worker community, and they said that they hadn't been involved in the initial planning of the program. Several mentioned that if they had, they would have advocated for something a little bit different. So I think that that's maybe one lesson learned here is, you know, when you're designing a program for farm workers, start talking to farm workers and people who work with farm workers right off the bat. What they did say was that the cash assistance that counties have provided, which is not state or federal funded, but counties have mounted these other services around Housing for Harvest on their own dime, like the ones that Kate mentioned, cash assistance, grocery assistance, on-call nursing, et cetera, that help farm workers quarantine at home. They said, well, why don't we spend the money that the state is willing to spend on hotel rooms on that instead for more people? And for example, in Riverside, where farm workers who tested positive were given a $2,000 check, the money has run out, and it ran out quickly. So there's been a lot of success with these other elements that counties have put together around Housing for the Harvest, but they have limited funds.
Georgia, given your work with the Documenting COVID-19 project, can you give us a sense of how many farm workers have tested positive in some of the counties where the Housing for the Harvest project had gone largely unutilized by the population it was intended to serve?
It's really hard to track. There really has been such a data lag in tracking COVID-19 farm workers. But in Tulare, for example, there was more that we found through obtaining data. There was more than 1,500 cases of COVID-19 positive agricultural workers since July and 40 deaths. But only 18 farm workers had made reservations. The Purdue tracker puts it at Purdue University, puts it at 16,500 sick farm workers across California, but as shown in the article, only 81 from since the Housing for the Harvest project started until mid-December have accessed the housing services.
So there were a handful of people who did take advantage of these services. Kate, can you let us know how helpful it was for those who did use the program?
The people that we spoke with who utilized the program services were thrilled. They said that it was just a huge help. We spoke with one young man down in Riverside County who he was the only person we managed to speak with who did utilize the hotel rooms. And, you know, he found that hugely helpful because he'd been living in his car for days trying to isolate from his parents. Another person we spoke with in Riverside County who, you know, decided because his whole family had tested positive for COVID-19. He said, you know, why should we stay in a hotel room? We don't need to. He decided to isolate at home with his family. He got groceries. He got the $2,000 cash assistance. And he
talk to me about how he and his wife work 7 days a week and have worked 7 days a week for most of their lives. And it's something that he's very proud of, but he talked to me about how he actually managed to take 2 or 3 days off of work. He didn't even work around the house during this time. He just sat around and recovered a little bit. And he had this like mix of pride and shame when he was talking to me about that. It was really striking that he was, you know, a little sad that he had taken this time off, but at the same time, he was so happy that this allowed him to take those 3 days to just kind of sit and recover and still meet his bills. He was still able to make his mortgage payment. He was still able to pay his utilities. For a lot of people, those wraparound services have been an absolute godsend.
So Jackie, you know, we've been talking about this program in the past tense, but it is an ongoing program. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. It is an ongoing program, and it is expected to go on for as long as there is need. In the nearly 6 months since it was announced, it took several months to actually start enrolling people, and it took another few months to get warmed up. But in the last few months, the numbers of people enrolling have been increasing. They're on the rise, and right now, with this current surge of coronavirus, administrators hopefully very much hope that the numbers will rise more as more farm workers are getting affected and that they can meet the need.
I was just going to add that I believe that we learned that from November to December, the numbers practically tripled.
Yeah.
That's quite remarkable. Has there been any conversation about reducing some of these hurdles or some of the barriers so that they may be able to even increase participation further?
When I spoke with the CDFA Undersecretary, Jenny Lester Moffitt, she said that they had been working the entire time to lower the barriers as much as they possibly could. There were some things they simply couldn't work around. For example, people must present a positive COVID test or a doctor's referral to get into the program. That's not something that they can just let go because FEMA is reimbursing the program as it goes along. So whether federal and state dollars involved, there's oftentimes a lot of red tape. But the things that they were working on were, for example, reaching out to people through trusted community partners that had already been embedded in the community for, you know, years or decades. That was one of the things that I believe that they're focusing on in order to increase enrollment and to make sure that people feel safe and comfortable sheltering in these hotel rooms.
Jackie Botts, you're a reporter with CalMatters, and this reporting is part of the California Divide Media Collaborative. Can you tell us a bit about that project and the importance of this work, particularly in light of how COVID-19 has exposed deeper levels of inequity in our state?
Yeah, the California Divide is a statewide media collaboration. Our main goal really is to raise awareness and engagement about poverty, income inequality, economic survival in California. And we have reporters stationed at the San Jose Mercury News, the Fresno Bee, La Opinion in Los Angeles, two reporters with Cal Matters. I'm one of them, Kate, with the Salinas Californian. And like you said, I think that the inequalities in California were perhaps never clearer than they are right now. We had been reporting as a part of this collaboration for about a year before the pandemic hit. And I think our previous reporting couldn't have prepared us more for what we would see, you know, these huge inequities and in who has to expose themselves, who tests positive, and even who dies in California based on income, race, and ethnicity. So we've been on the story, and like you said, I don't think it's ever been more important.
Well, we've been talking with Jackie Botts, a journalist for CalMatters, Kate Cimini, a journalist with Salinas Californian, and Georgia G, a journalist for the Documenting COVID-19 Project. Thank you all for being with us. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. It's been 3 weeks since the last Valley Edition, and although we've taken a break, COVID-19 has not. Even as the vaccine slowly makes its way into people's arms, the virus is still devastating the San Joaquin Valley and filling hospitals to dangerous levels. Here to catch us up with the latest developments is FM89 health reporter Carrie Klein with our first COVID-19 update of 2021. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thank you, Kathleen.
During our last update in mid-December, the Valley was seeing a record-breaking surge in cases following the Thanksgiving break. What's happened since then? Are we over that surge? If we are over it, we're not far beyond it. You know, more than 2,500 cases are still being reported every day in the seven counties where we broadcast. The biggest days for new cases were concentrated in the last 10 days of December, but these numbers fluctuate so much every day that it's still really difficult to tell whether they're improving or not. Where they're definitely not improving is in the number of people dying from COVID-19. So on Tuesday alone this week, there were reports of 129 deaths in our coverage area. That's twice what it was 2 weeks ago. Also complicating all of these numbers is that county health departments keep adjusting, they keep tweaking their reporting methods. So, you know, Merced and Tulare counties, for example, they hardly reported any new data between Christmas and New Year's, and then updated them all at once on a couple of days. Fresno County is now updating its COVID-related deaths only about once a week. And whenever they do, that number jumps by about 50 or 100 people. So it's really quite hard to pin down what is actually changing day by day. And inconsistent data reporting has a lot to do with that.
And how are our hospitals faring?
So right now, our local hospitals have the most COVID patients they've had yet in the pandemic. That's more than 1,500 patients in total in our coverage area, and that's 50% more than during the height of the summer surge. The state calculates availability in intensive care units every day, and here in the San Joaquin Valley, we've been at 0% since December 17th. As a caveat, you know, it's important to know this data is calculated at only, you know, one specific moment each day, so beds are opening up or filling up, you know, at any number of times during each day. So that might not actually mean there are zero beds, but there are very, very few of them. Simultaneously to all of this, hospital workers are falling ill. And those who spend significant time with COVID-positive patients must go out on quarantine for 10 days before returning to work, even if they themselves are not ill. And so, you know, for example, Community Medical Center is one of the largest hospital systems in the area. They have 283 employees currently with COVID-19 and another 100 out in isolation. At Cahuilla Delta, 173 employees have COVID. And at St. Agnes, another 112 are in self-isolation. So, you know, these are not all record high numbers at this point for each one of these facilities, but they're still extremely high. All of this together is one reason that, you know, at the end of December, Fresno, Kings, and Madera counties instituted a new ambulance policy. So if you call 911 and you're not experiencing a true emergency, they will not take you to the emergency room. You know, the counties have tasked paramedics with evaluating the need of patients who call 911, and they'll refer you to urgent care or a primary care doctor if they feel you don't actually need the emergency room. This may actually sound like a fairly logical policy to have in place, but it is certainly a departure from before when, you know, ambulances would transport everyone to the ER who called them. On the flip side, however, there has been some relief to all of this. The Department of Defense sent a team of 20 providers from largely from the Air Force to Community Regional Medical Center at the end of December, and they are helping to staff an additional 10 ICU beds that would not have been available before.
There's been a lot of talk at hospitals in other parts of the state about rationing care or supplies. Has that been happening here?
I don't believe so, and at least not in any really significant way. You know, here's Fresno County Interim Health Officer Dr. Race Vora when he was asked that question during a media call earlier in the week.
You know, our hospitals, especially the one where I have privileges, is never going to have the luxury to just ration care. I mean, we're a level one trauma center. We're the only level one trauma center in the whole valley. And so we'll always have to, you know, provide that level of care.
He, of course, is talking about Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno. However, state health officials are putting together crisis plans that address what to do if hospital patient loads keep creeping up much higher than they already are.
Well, now let's pivot to the COVID-19 vaccine. When we last spoke, the first vaccine shipments had arrived at local hospitals and were just starting to be shot into doctors' arms. How has the vaccine rollout been since then?
It's actually been relatively smooth, just not quite as fast as I think health officials were expecting. There was one big hiccup in December, and that was that Fresno County had to return one entire shipment of the Moderna vaccine. That's 5,600 doses. That's because when they arrived, the data logger that keeps track of the temperature of the package reported some kind of error during transportation. It wasn't entirely clear what that was, but after talking with Moderna, the county returned those shipments, and then Moderna replaced all 5,600 doses within 48 hours. As far as I know, that's been the only major hindrance so far, according to county officials. And of course, there are kind of these national issues of, you know, Pfizer did not actually end up shipping as many doses initially as they had promised. We've also heard stories from other parts of the state of, you know, some doses being left out on counters and hospitals having to scramble to get those shots in arms before they expire. But as far as I know, there's been nothing of that sort in this area.
So how many vaccine doses have we received and where have those gone so far?
So statewide, California has now received a little over 2 million doses of both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. As of earlier this week, however, only a quarter of those had actually been administered. So that's only, you know, under 500,000 in total. So here in the Valley, around 18,000 people have gotten the vaccine. The state has not provided enough data to say what share that represents of all the vaccines that have been delivered here. But in Fresno County, at least, officials say only around 50 or 60% of those vaccines have been administered so far. It's also not even close to the total number of healthcare workers that are prioritized in this first wave of vaccines. Fresno County alone has more than 30,000 healthcare workers that would qualify.
Why is the vaccination rate so low?
Part of it is simply the logistics of getting these vaccines out. You know, there are only so many clinics and hospitals that are qualified to administer them, and they need to work out how to notify people, how to set up appointments, and keep track of those people in order to make sure they get their second doses. You know, this was also the holidays was, you know, around when this was all arriving in California. And of course, just like in the general population, there are medical providers and healthcare workers who are reluctant to get the vaccine. Maybe they've had a bad experience with shots in the past, or maybe they feel that the development of the vaccine has been rushed. Here's Joe Prado. He's Fresno County's Community Health Division Manager, also on a media call earlier this week.
It's concerning with 60 or 50% of individuals wanting the vaccine right now. We want that number to be higher. At the same time, we want our community to have the space to make that decision so they can make an informed decision and feel good about the decision that I want to go and get vaccinated.
So he says that, you know, that 50 to 60% number of the vaccines that have been taken so far, he says that represents a starting point and an opportunity for improvement.
Can you give us a sense of what we should expect in the coming weeks and months as the vaccine continues to roll out?
So every county is handling vaccinations on its own. So they're all going to be at slightly different stages, handling registration, logistics, all differently. But in general, we're in a part of the state's vaccination plan known as Phase 1A, which prioritizes healthcare staff with the most exposure to at-risk patients. And also some of those patients themselves as well. You know, this includes people at hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, ambulances, or dialysis centers. Dentist offices may soon be able to administer the vaccine, assuming they can get waivers from the state. Prison staff and farm workers may also be qualifying soon to get the vaccine. But like I said, this all kind of varies by county. And unfortunately, this is all happening in front of the backdrop that health officials are expecting another big surge coming out of the December holidays.
Well, Carrie, this has been such an informative update. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. High Quality Bakery in downtown Fresno closed at the end of December after 63 years in business. In this audio postcard, Sammy and Paula Ghanemian tell FM89's Sarith Hawk about the role this iconic business has played in the Armenian community.
Last day.
Hey, my name is Sammy Ghanemian, and I'm the owner of High Quality Bakery.
You know, it comes a time for all good things to end, I think. I love hearing all the comments from the customers about, you know, how they've enjoyed eating the product all their lives. I mean, three generations have been using our bread all these years.
My name is Paula Ghanemian, and I'm co-owner of High Quality Bakery. We make Armenian cracker bread, we make the crisp, and we make the soft high roller, which they use to make roll-up sandwiches. And we've had customers using the high roller for over 20 years, the same customers. In fact, as a courtesy, I called many of them to tell them that we are closing, and they were just like flabbergasted. So most of them made their last order so that they would have one more time to be able to have the product.
My name is Jacob Mayer, and I'm here to pick up some Armenian bread from High Bakery. You know, my great-grandfather used to make them back in the day for his children, and it just was a recipe passed down. The cracker bread is our favorite thing from here.
Yeah, my mother and father. In 1957, they started the bakery. It was right down the street at 537 L Street. The building is still there. I bought this property from one of our customers, Steve Pilibos. And he said, I'll sell you that property down the street and you can build a building there.
People have been coming in really to say goodbye, and there's not much left to sell, but we've appreciated that they've made the effort to come in to say goodbye. We want to thank you for all you have done for our family, our church, St. Vartan's in Oakland, and the Armenian community. Wish you all the best in your future endeavors. Congratulations on all you have achieved. Sincerely, Nora and Howard Hanoyan. P.S. We will also remember the tour you gave us and our kids. You were so proud of your baking methods, proud that the Hanoyan's Market was the first to carry your cracker bread. Yeah, so that was really sweet. Very sweet that she took the time to write that note. Hanoyan's Market, which is long closed, was our first market that he delivered to in his folks' old 64 Lincoln.
Yeah, we didn't have a van. We delivered it in the old car, in the car. Didn't even have boxes. Put the bread in the back of the car and in the trunk and delivered it there.
I'm Patrice Rubel, and I have been a customer here, but more importantly, I have been friends with the Ghanemian family for a very long time. I'm very sad that things are closing, but they have certainly put in their time serving the community and serving the Armenian community probably especially so that we can get things that are near and dear to us from either our childhood or what we want.
They're not customers, you know, they're friends, and you've developed this relationship. And three generations have gone through High Quality Bakery, and that's quite an accomplishment.
It's just a lifetime of conversation over the counter. So that will be missed. The hard work won't be missed. So certainly the loyalty of our in-store customers, and we have had many wholesale customers that have been loyal for 20 plus years. So that's why we were able to survive 63 years. So we've worked side by side in this building for 44 years, and now it's time for us to have some fun time together where we don't have to worry about stress of work.
I've never retired before. I don't know what it's like. And it's going to be a new experience. This is a new chapter in our lives, really. It is.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.